thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching up with us, we're listening to Straight Talk about the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
Sir, you've been having your hand up.
In Mondragon, I believe my family come from a Basque tradition.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I believe in Mondragon, that was an immigrant society that set that whole thing up. It was a bunch of people that were fleeing from various forces, military forces, and actually were hiding out there, and later on kind of started their own little cities and stuff like that. And they were so small, nobody could care less, you know. But it seems to me that a lot of progress, as far as social issues is concerned, is done by immigrants. In other words, people that are so fed up in Germany, Finland, Sweden, Greece, came over and immigrated to the United States and set up their own communities and basically got established in the same type of political, economic cells that you're talking about. How important is immigration and cell structure to forming the type of alliance that you want to do?
I don't know the answer to your question, but we haven't seen what you're talking about as a significant part of what we've seen around the country.
Okay.
It seems to be pretty much down home America.
People don't come into that community from other places?
We haven't seen that phenomenon. It might be true, but I couldn't answer that specifically. I haven't seen it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just going to say in response to that question about global cooperation, my impression, which is maybe very stereotypical, is Americans have tended to come up with this, have been brought up with this idea of rugged individualism and you self-made people and all this. And a lot of other cultures, more particularly ancient and indigenous and long, have been very communal and would remain so if mm-hmm. our imperialism and our corporations didn't interfere. So
and
I don't
develop more technologies for, that's another possibility, yes. Sir.
Gar, you make a very convincing case for building like a radical reformist, you know, kind of nonviolent movement in the United States. I think that, you know, what you're recommending should be taken to the max. Like in Madison, for example, liberal and progressive alders here don't want to touch the issue of where most of the city's tax revenues are parked, in U.S. Bank and Bank of America. I mean, that money could be taken. Why shouldn't we have a big hydroponic, you know, enterprise cooperative here? I mean, we have a tradition in Madison of green, you know, community-supported agriculture. That said, one of my concerns, however, is that even if we push this to the max, it's probable that only maybe 5 to 10% of the American population could be reorganized into such enterprises, and that would be a huge achievement. But the rest of the workforce trapped, you know, in these corporate enterprises, top down, and with the huge wealth inequalities and the fact so much land and productive assets are controlled by the 1% or at least the upper 5%, don't you think the time is going to come when it's going to be necessary while we're building this alternative economy to have a mass movement like the civil rights movement, kind of a combination of what the civil rights movement and the old militant style labor movement to also directly assault, you know, the corporate capitalist class in direct action in workplaces, communities, and in the streets. I mean, my main concern is that I have seen, and I'm not saying this is true of you, but I've seen advocates for co-ops.
Yep.
Pose co-ops as an alternative. They counterpose it to more traditional forms of class struggle. And I find that when that's done, it's dangerous and it's counter-radical as far as I'm concerned.
So the question you asked me was, don't you think there'll have to be a far more powerful, transformative, radical transformative movement
right.
to achieve real change?
Thank
and the
you.
Answer is yes. but no, but let me say, but I say that in a very careful way. I don't think the movements that I know anything about have an idea or a clue in their head what they'd put in the place of corporate capitalism if they actually won. They don't have an idea. It's rhetoric. It's bull. And until we learn and develop and know what the hell we want that would produce a democratic system based on transforming the ownership of wealth, we ought to be careful about that. So what I am talking about in the maximum transformative possibility, the conclusion of the book, I mean, as I say, that we don't, you never know about history. It could, Rome decayed. That's a possibility. Or repression is a possibility. What the argument is that if there, what is necessary in all cases is to learn enough and develop enough and begin to really build out so we have clarity about a system that we would want to live in. And we don't. And one of the ways you get that clarity is by learning and building and theorizing and developing. And that possibility is an extraordinarily exciting possibility. It ain't happened before. We live in a time where that possibility may be opening up, where you actually see on the ground people experimenting in more and more sophisticated ways with transforming ownership in a democratic way. That's a big deal. Now, that gets you pretty far, but it doesn't get you to transforming either in terms of political power, and that's certainly not even a systemic design. That's elements that point in the direction of a vision. To put that a little more clearly, we would have to really debate, that's the afterword of the book, and that's a talk I gave at the sociology department today, it's time to put the question of design on the table. If you don't like corporate capitalism, you don't like state socialism, what the hell do you want? And tell me why it would work better. That's a profound intellectual challenge, as well as a political problem. For those of you who are interested, I wrote a piece for Truth Out last week, which lays out some of the questions here. That's on the table, and there's intellectual work as well as political work to do on that, because people don't know. And so, yes, I do agree, ultimately, there's the question of power is ultimately involved in this, and that requires a powerful movement. Sir?
I have a couple different questions. One thought is, power's concentrated. Power never concedes power without a struggle, basically. If you look at the Youngstown example, that seems to be a pretty good indication of what would happen if you or this movement starts to be effective. And where I want to go with that, two things.
Can I introduce?
Sure, sure.
I want to say
sure.
Because I forgot to say something.
Okay. Yeah.
So okay, because Youngstown didn't happen, and the steelworkers union was against it.
Yeah.
And 30 years later, there's lots of steelwork. There's a lot of companies, and there's Cleveland is a new model. Yeah. What I forgot to mention is that in the process of development over 30 years, the International Steelworkers Union is now supporting worker owners as a major initiative. So there's transformation within that institution as well. And so is SEIU, by the way, and so are several other major unions. So if you think of it as a historian, there's a process at work even in labor unions, some of them, and the steelworkers being important because they were dead against it, and now they're dead for it, promoting it all over the country. So anyway, I just wanted to introduce the historical process.
Yeah, and that's good. And that's part of my other question is, if you're looking at history and you're talking about, you know, two or three decades, I wonder, isn't history accelerating quite a bit faster than we're used to? And, you know, do we really, I don't perceive that we have two or three decades to develop something new. And where it all leads to is, what about the zeitgeist movie or concept of changing from a monetary to a resource-based economy? Do you see that? This system you're talking about, I think, maintains a monetary economy, but it democratizes money. We own it, perhaps state banks or credit unions. What about that zeitgeist? I don't know enough about resource-based economy. So could you say something about that?
Probably not enough, no. There is a whole ecological and resource aspect of this discussion, mm-hmm. which I only began to touch on when I talked about the ecological aspects of it. And there's a lot of pressure coming in from that side of it, in terms of climate change particularly, and growth as well. There's resource limits. I suspect, if you look closely at that, things are going to get worse, that we aren't going to solve the climate change problem quickly, as Bill McKibben keeps hoping we could, but that you can't get there from here unless you change the power structure, which means that the kind of things I'm talking about are a precondition. By the way, you guys know large American corporations must grow. They have no choice. If they don't grow, Wall Street will kill them. So good guys running large corporations are under, they must grow. So if you're worried about resource limits, that animal won't do it, period. So you're going to have to make it into something that doesn't have a nonprofit or utility that doesn't, public utility doesn't have to. So I don't know the answer to your question, but the resource limits problem certainly is very real there.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now back to the next American Revolution with Gar Opperbitz.
What about history going faster than
I don't know about that. history going faster or slower, I don't even know what that means.
You don't see that things, that changes are coming much more quickly than we're used to. If we look back over the last 5 decades and we try to predict something over the next 5 decades.
I don't think that's an easy proposition. You'd have to go case by case, and I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm cautious. I'm very cautious about making that kind of a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Sir?
So just following up on the question from there, what examples do you see of this integration, if maybe, between the traditional forms of class struggle or movement-building efforts through community organizing and this alternative way of building this new economy? I ask that because I'm trying to understand how do these co-ops get capital to start, and what are the opportunities for engaging these as a way of getting capital,
right,
whether it's through tax reform or whatever.
So there are two questions, and they're kind of related sometimes. So let me say about the capital question, because that's really interesting question, and I want to come back to the other. You all have hospitals and universities, because this is a good place to start. Every major community has got significant scale with a lot of taxpayer money in it. Okay, that's open to political demand. We're paying for you. We want, and some of those guys want to do it on their own, leaving aside that. The Cleveland Clinics, the Cleveland Laundry, which was the first one of the co-ops, the big industrial-scale laundry, was financed with bank capital at the height of the worst financial crisis in modern American history. Nobody could get loans. Now, how did they do that? You walk into a bank with a contract from the big hospital, bam, you've got a golden contract because the capital works. You've got a business proposition, makes sense. So controlling the sources of the market, in this case, purchases from a hospital or university, gives you, that's the way most corporations do it too, they've got to have a market that is fundable, gives you one source of capital. It's a good business proposition. So that's one way to do it with the banks. Another way to do it is, do you guys know the term, it's community agreements, various forms of community. The strategy is you get, community brings pressure against a developer, for instance. And then they force him, if he wants to continue his development, to actually give the community a number of concessions. And that's going on all over the country. I'm blocking the words. Community benefits agreement. I'm just blocking the term. That process, I've been talking to organizers about it, they think could be adapted to getting more capital as well as business opportunities as well. So you bring an organizing part in. I'm actually meeting Sunday morning with the National People's Action Group, and they're looking at exactly how you integrate these kinds of strategies with traditional organizing strategies. And that's another piece of, if you watch the politics of this, organizers are beginning to realize they've got to get into the economy and beginning to say, how do we put it together? So, for instance, this is one of the things people are talking about. Teachers and hospital workers and public service employees, you guys know better than anybody, this is Wisconsin, under tremendous pressure. Politicians, right-wing politicians, mobilize the taxpayers against the public service employees. There's no way out of that unless you can increase the tax base so that you get more tax revenues directly. One of the ways to do that is through building up a whole economy locally that involves changing the ownership, because it doesn't run away. Worker-owned companies do not run away because they're there. So can there be a strategy using community benefits agreements, using worker-owned companies that stabilize the jobs, getting the mayor to help you in the hospital and so forth, and beginning to build that up, and using that the way to blunt this taxpayer attack because you're building the tax base? So that's a strategic way that people are beginning to talk about experimenting with. But this is wide open for innovation. If you actually get in there, roll your sleeves up, you're going to find a lot of people looking at this question trying to figure out just what you're talking about. How do we actually do this? Can you get some of those banks into public hands or quasi-public hands, or get a politician to say, running for mayor, I'm going to give part of it's going to finance new community development stuff? The mayor of Cleveland looks fantastic. He looks politically great. He's getting all these jobs for people. It looks good. It's positive, not negative. So there's a lot of opportunity for people to innovate. Not easy, but it's available in many parts. And we shall see, maybe or maybe not, how far it'll go. One or two more questions, I think, probably, and then we'll take a minute again. Way back, you haven't had a question.
I'm involved with the workers' co-op, and I certainly understand what they're capable of and what scale they work well at. Most of the businesses within a mile of this place could probably work very well as workers' co-ops. But, what kind of a vision could you imagine that would replace General Motors in a more democratic fashion? Because, there are certainly economies of scale, way beyond what Mondragon has been capable of, that I don't know how you do it.
Well, no, I don't either. That's the challenge for, it's an obvious challenge. For large, there's a whole technological issue going on here, too. I mean, I was lecturing at MIT, and you hear the guys who are the scientists up there talking about the new technologies and, you know, 3D printing, but that's just the beginning. So there's possibilities of radical decentralization. I don't know about that. But nonetheless, the challenge is taking large, what do you do about large institutions becomes the really interesting question of all this. And it may well be that a culture of democratic participation built up around the communities has got some of these elephants in it that they just have to contain and manage because they're elephants. I don't know about that. But it's another area for intellectual research. What is the best we know that's been done? Where could be done better? Because these are real questions. You see, I love these questions. I like these last two questions particularly because they are constructive questions we can work on. You can experiment. There's a lot of different ways to get at this, how you get the capital. I'll give you two or three different ones. There's probably 10 more if you really look, and probably 10 more that people are doing that I don't know about. This is a really interesting question, like the university question. What the hell do we want? You don't like the system? What do you want? The ball's in your court, so in our court. And so what I like about this emerging development and, you know, what then must we do, the title of the book, is it instead of moaning and groaning, the question becomes our responsibility. If you don't like what you see, what do you want? Really? And it involves really difficult questions, like what do you do about very large industry? And what do you do about it? We haven't even talked about this one, so I'll drop another one at the end here. What do you do about a continental scale system of almost 3,000 miles at over 300 million, moving to 500 million, and if the Census Bureau high projection is right, it's 1.1 billion by the end of the century. Probably won't get there. You tell me how you do participatory democracy in that system. William Upham Williams, the great historian who taught at this university, argued that inevitably this system was too large to manage democratically, and most states were too small, and the intermediate unit was called a region, that there would be regional decentralization. Maybe that's so. You want to think about it another way. But the question becomes, what makes sense? It's time to begin answering the questions. This rickety old constitution, which is absurd in many ways. There's something like 20 states have as many votes in the Senate taken together as California. And that was done for race reasons. It was done to solve a negotiation over slavery. Come on. And we're living, you have to think again about the constitutional structure, really, because that system is out of whack. And just to take another piece of it. Most of the models that we talk about in terms of social democracy, we could do like the Germans do, we could do like the Swedes do, etc. Those are small. I used to tell my students, they love this, you guys will get a kick out of it. I said, those are dinky little countries, like Germany. Now, what I meant by that was, it's much easier to organize a politics in a reasonably sized country. You can drop Germany into Montana. They are very small geographic polities. We're in a continent. So I think Williams is probably right. Decentralization of some form. And if you're talking about the next century, we're talking about how the system gets restructured, including constitutional issues. I've been talking to the president of the American Political Science Association and the president of the Sociology Association. They're into this big time. What does the next system really look like? And how do we begin thinking about it? Both leading figures in those two professions are beginning to ask these kinds of questions. And the questions of industrial scale have got to be on the table. And believe it or not, some of the business schools are beginning to ask that. There are progressives in some of the... I gave a lecture today at the sociology department. There's a guy who comes up to me after he's a professor in the business school. I gave something like the same discussion. And he said, I agree with you entirely. We're working on design problems. What? Just to give you some idea, because the press doesn't cover this. The Academy of Management is meeting in Florida this summer. They go there. Everybody goes to Florida or Puerto Rico because it's cheap in the summer, right? Or Nevada. There'll be 10,000 management consultants, all of whom work basically for the large corporations. Go to the website and read what the manifest is. Is capitalism over? What do we do about capitalism? Is there a different system? That's what they're talking about. That's what the guy who did the Swedish, you know, the thing that happens in Switzerland at, I want to say Demos. It's that little town in Switzerland. Davos. The guy who opened it up saying, the problem before us, this is one of the leading corporate guys, is capitalism over? He says that. I'm not saying that. And they're asking questions because they realize that there are really big problems in the system, big problems. And they understand that. I was amazed at the management association. It reads like a very sophisticated. It could have been written by a Marxist, but in very gray flannel clothes. But the analysis was extremely radical. But it was written in business language. And you know, and another sign of the times. They've asked me to come and keynote part of that conference. Something's going on. Something's going on in this country. People know there is a big problem, not like usual. And so you know, you probably heard me say this enough. If it's to be a democratic transformation, even a shot at a democratic transformation, the ball is in our court, like the person sitting in your seat or standing here. Otherwise, they do it, and it will end up some other way. So I think this is a closing line, right? I think this is maybe the most important period of American history, bar none. including the revolution, including the Civil War, because the system, I believe, is coming to the end of its capacities, politically as well as economically as well as ecologically. And it may decay, or it may go to violence, but it may also become transformative. And it's coming to the end, in my view, for the reasons I tried to lay out. There are lots of things that are failing before your eyes. But in the end, it becomes a personal, the question, yeah. I'm a historian, a political economist, I've done politics, been there, done all that, et cetera, et cetera. The question you know is none of the above. The question is existential. What will you or I actually do is a personal question. Thanks very much.
Live.